Welcome to the Motley Fool Radio Show. I'm David Gardner, broadcasting from Fool Global Headquarters here in Alexandria, Virginia. We're here each week to talk about the motley world of business and investing. On this week's show, we'll talk to Dave and Buster about their restaurant arcade business, Dave and Buster's. It's a place chock full of video games. It's been a pretty good stock over the years. This is kind of a Chuck E. Cheese business for adults, for big kids. But we begin with an encore presentation of a conversation we had with a rather motley economist. Stephen Levitt teaches economics at the University of Chicago. He's the author of a new book, Freakonomics. A rogue economist explores the hidden side of everything, a book he co-authored with Stephen Dubner. He joins us from the NPR Bureau in Chicago, Illinois. Stephen Levitt, welcome to the Motley Fool Radio Show.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Stephen, what is Freakonomics?
Well, Freakonomics is our lighthearted take on economics. It takes the tools of economics, but applies them in places people don't look, you know, crack gangs and parenting and looking at swimming pools versus guns, kind of questions that economists haven't typically turned their sights on.
Okay, now, Stephen Levitt, I want to take a look at a few of the questions that you pose in your book and have you take a crack at answering them here on the show. Question number one, do real estate agents really represent their clients' interests? That is, of course, a highly relevant question to many listeners of the Motley Fool Radio Show. Do they?
Good ones do, but the ones who do are actually working against their own best outcome in terms of incentives. The way real estate contracts are structured, you pay a 6% fee to your realtor, which it seems unbelievably high, and I think is unbelievably high. But if you start parsing it out, half of that will go to the buyer's realtor and half to the seller's realtor. Half of that half will go to the company of the realtor. So your own realtor only gets 1.5% of any extra money that he or she gets for you. So if you can sell your house for $10,000 more through some extra effort by your realtor, that's only $150 in his or her pocket. So if they have to pay for the advertising, do a bunch of open houses, it's very much in their self-interest to try to kind of trick you, cajole you into taking offers that are not nearly as good as you could get if you waited. And indeed, in the data, that seems to be true, that realtors, when they sell their own houses, they get about 2% to 3% more for them, and they also wait longer. They wait about 10% longer to make the sale, both of which are consistent with the idea that they're doing better for themselves and for you, and the mechanism is by tricking you into taking offers that are not good enough.
Mm. And in fact, you write about real estate terms correlated to a higher sales price. I want to stick on this topic for a second. Granite, state-of-the-art, Corian, maple, and gourmet. Again, real estate terms correlating to a higher sales price.
Absolutely. So when realtors use words that actually describe your house, that tends to be good. You know, things that are state-of-the-art says you have a great kitchen. But when realtors are saying great neighborhood or spacious, or one of the worst offenders is when there are a lot of exclamation points. Those are just empty words that don't mean anything. Even worse are the code words, which when the old lady sells her house and it's listed as well maintained, the old lady thinks, hey, that's great. I did do a good job of maintaining my house. Actually, that's code word for this is a pretty crappy house.
I've always loved the phrase handyman's dream.
Yeah, handyman's dream. That's trying to make something good out of something not so good.
Real fixer-upper, okay. Next topic, question number two I wanted to ask you that you answer in the book. Why do so many drug dealers live with their moms? I guess I have to admit, being the naive fool that I am, I didn't actually realize that they do. You're saying they do, and you're explaining why.
Yeah, the answer is because if you're at the bottom of a drug dealing gang, it's not too different than being at the bottom of McDonald's. You're making something like minimum wage, and you're living with your mom because you can't afford to do anything different.
Hmm. Really runs in contrast to the way that drug dealers are portrayed through, I don't know, action cinema.
Hey, so that's conventional wisdom for you. That's a classic case of where society, and I think in particular police departments, have wanted to portray drug dealers and Hollywood as well, I guess, mm-hmm. as being big, thriving, successful, you know, rich guys, because then it makes them, you know, better bad guys. Mm. Now, the guys at the top are, don't get me wrong. It's just like a modern corporation. The guys at the top of the gang are making huge salaries, just like the top executives are at McDonald's. But there are a few guys at the top of these gangs. They're just as hierarchical as corporations.
Mm. We're talking with Stephen Levitt, the author of Freakonomics. A rogue economist explores the hidden side of everything. Let's talk about a few other case studies you write about. Stephen, have you elaborate? Tell us what the takeaway is. Daycare parents and fines for late pickups.
Yeah, so there was a study done by another set of economists in which in Israel there was a daycare that was having a lot of late pickups, and they decided to institute fines. I mean, very small fines, it turned out, $3, $4 fines that went along with parents coming late. And the surprising result was when they instituted the fine, the number of late pickups actually went up. So what's the answer to that? Why, when it used to be free to come late and now there's a dollar value on it, why didn't more people come late? Well, the answer turns out that essentially by making such a small fine, they've essentially taken this from being a kind of moral or social incentive where I feel terrible for the daycare worker if I don't show up. Now I show up late. Well, if it's only worth $3 to the daycare, then it's worth a lot more than to me to finish my tennis match or, you know, my haircut. And so they've essentially substituted financial punishments for moral punishments. And in this case, it turned out moral punishments were much better. Now, on the other hand, were the fine $500 or $1,000 for picking up your child late? I think that would have worked pretty well.
Mm. Next one for you. Paul Feldman's bagel business. Please explain.
So Paul Feldman was a PhD economist who had worked for 20 years as being in economics, got frustrated, decided his time would be better spent dropping off bagels and donuts in the morning at office parks, along with a little lockbox, and having people put money into the lockbox on the honor system. And he collected this data from hundreds of companies he'd go to each week for 20 years, a spreadsheet with all this data in it. And surprisingly, it actually gave us a window into questions of honesty and white-collar crime, because we can track day by day how much is in the lockbox relative to how much you would expect to be in the lockbox. And a couple things emerge. One is that people, by and large, are pretty honest, that Paul finds, the big man finds, that about 90% of the money he expects to get shows up in the lockbox. And it varies with a lot of, it varies systematically. So, for instance, after 9/11, his deliveries are in Washington, D.C., after 9/11, he found that people became much more honest. Something about 9/11 changed people's willingness to rip off the bagel man. He also finds, when we analyze the data, that the big offices tend to be stealing more from Paul than the little offices. And also with the weather, it turns out weather and holidays matter. Bad weather's bad for payment. And the holidays, the stressful holidays, whether it be Thanksgiving or Christmas or Valentine's Day, whenever there's a holiday with an expectation, people steal more.
I'm going to close with our signature game, Buy, Sell, or Hold. We play it with every guest in this show. Stephen, I'll be asking you about things happening in our world at large and ask you if they were stocks, which they're not, but if they were, would you be buying, selling, or holding right now? And a sentence as to why. You ready?
Sure am.
Let's kick it off with, well, it's something you explore in your book, Buy, Sell, or Hold, The Importance of Parenting in Shaping a Child.
I would be selling The Importance of Parenting, that our research suggests that the things you do with your kid, whether it's spanking, taking them to a museum, reading them, none of them turn out to be very important in predicting at least the test scores your child will
wow.
have when he shows up at school.
And so what is important?
We think what's important is who you are. So the choices you've made earlier in your life. Are you well-educated? Are you loving and secure financially? Those are the kind of aspects of parenting that really seem to matter. Having good genes can't hurt either.
Mm. So your genes, obviously, but then also just your station in life, kind of what you've learned and maybe perhaps what you confer to your children without even meaning to. Those things are maybe underrated.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Buy, sell, or hold, betting on the horses.
Well, I would probably hold that. It's a lot of fun. It's not easy to do well. But actually, the chances for somebody smart to do well at that have actually gone way up. The percent that the track takes is actually going down. And now with online betting, you can really access thousands of races a day, and so you at least have a shot. It's like having access to 1,000 stocks to pick instead of 10. You got a much better shot if you got 1,000 to choose from than 10.
Do you think there really are people out there who have systems or otherwise who can consistently make money betting on horses?
Well, they won't make good money. It is hard to make good money, but I'm good enough at it myself to about break even, having put in a fair amount of effort. I'm sure there are people better than me, but the only people I know who get rich betting on horses do it in Hong Kong. It turns out Hong Kong have huge pools and apparently very inefficient markets. Mm. I've never myself dabbled in Hong Kong horse racing, but there are people who claim to get rich doing that.
Information advantage.
Absolutely.
Stepping away from it for a second, Stephen, let me ask you this, very relevant to the show. Do you believe that people can beat the stock market consistently and over time?
Well, I'm not one of those rabid, efficient market guys who thinks that there's absolutely no way to beat anything. I think the markets are like 99.9% efficient, and still the markets are so big that point, you know, 1% that's inefficient potentially leads you to be able to make some money. I mean, I think the evidence kind of speaks against it. I think it's hard to beat the markets, but you know, I think if you combine how much fun it is to try to beat the market with the speculation that maybe you're just going to be the one who can do it, I think it's a good pastime.
To close, Stephen, we understand that one of your great uncles wrote this book and another great uncle wrote this song. So have to ask you to close, buy, sell, or hold Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
I would definitely buy on Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. It just goes to show you if you need Jews to write your Christmas songs, it's got to be a good indicator.
Stephen Levitt is the author of Freakonomics, A Rogue Economist Explores the Hidden Side of Everything. He joined us from the NPR Bureau in Chicago, Illinois. Stephen Levitt, thanks for joining us on the Motley Fool Radio Show.
Thanks for having me, David.
Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer had a very shiny nose, and if you ever saw it, you would even say it glows. All of the other reindeer used to laugh and call him names. They never let poor Rudolph